On this episode of Still Loading, Mike Micah. And welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I am your host, Josh Koval, and today it is a first for the show. I'm very happy for this episode. Today on the podcast, I have my first ever game developer on the podcast, and this has been something I've been wanting to do for a while. Today's episode is going to be kind of more of just an interview about his career, but at some point, whether it's him or someone else, I would love to do deep dives on individual games with the developers that worked on them. So that is a long-term goal, so I'm putting it out into ether right now so all of you can hold me accountable to it. But with me today, first time I've ever had a game developer on. He is an industry veteran for 20 years, right? 20 plus years.
Yep.
And he has worked on numerous games. Most recently, he's been doing a lot of retro re-releases with the Mega Man Legacy Collection. I think you also did the SNK 40th Collection. He currently works at Digital Eclipse and Other Ocean. Mike Micah is on the podcast today. Mike, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Josh. This is awesome to be on here, and I feel special to be the inaugural game developer episode.
I'm so happy that you agreed to come on. It's something where I'm never quite sure. When I reach out to people, I'm always like, I just don't really expect to hear anything back from them. So I was, especially through a Twitter DM, thank you so much for responding to that, because I don't get a lot of interviews from people who will contact me back through there. So to dive right into it, what's some of your earliest gaming memories? I always like to ask this for everyone that I interview. What first got you into video games and/or what are some of your earliest gaming memories?
You know, I'm old, so it's it goes way back, because I remember times before video games. So to me, I was just this kid who, really young, I had just seen Star Wars at the age of 3. And so in my mind, science fiction couldn't be any better. That was mind blowing. It was awesome. We would go to the drive-in all the time. I saw Star Wars at the drive-in. I would go see all these old sci-fi movies and stuff at the drive-in with my parents. And one time we went and we would go to the Rotunda. And I remember it was a habit trail I was used to, but this time around it was very different because there was this huge crowd in the Rotunda and they're all standing around a Space Invaders machine. And it was the first video game I had ever seen. And not only was it the first game I'd ever seen, but it was also so foreign and it was so different from any expectation I could have had of what it could have been. I remember just at the time, TVs were for watching linear content. They had a beginning and an end. You had no direct control of it. The concept of controlling a thing was not even anywhere in my neurons. So it was just magic. And so seeing that all happening and stuff, that was one of the biggest, I'd say most impactful memories I have about my first introduction to games. And at home, not too long after that, my dad had brought home, it was called a Rally 4. I have one in the box around here somewhere. It was a Radio Shack-esque version of Pong. It was a knockoff Pong.
It was one of the Pong clones?
Yeah, and it was it had wood paneling on it and this weird plastic white, off-white color and stuff. But, Pong is a two-player game, so it's it was great and an incredible novelty to play with my dad, but he got bored quick and, my friends got bored of it quick. So I would basically, in a sad state, sit there and just learn how to play the game by myself by having one hand on each controller and try to figure out how to make that more and more difficult and stuff like that. And that led to, I think a year after that was when we got the Atari 2600. And so those videos you see on YouTube of kids screaming or they tear something open, it wasn't as dramatic as that because I didn't even know what an Atari was. So I just remember opening it. And it took me probably way too long to process that it was a game system. I think it actually took really looking at the screenshots and seeing Space Invaders on the box and realizing wait, this is Space Invaders.
Because at that time, that would have been your only point of reference to what a video game was.
Exactly.
Nothing really else resonated as a video game.
Exactly. So once we hooked up to the TV, I was hooked. And that kind of, I think that was the beginning of the end for me as far as my fascination. I would be forever fascinated with video games.
That's kind of funny. I apologize to the listeners because they've probably heard these stories before, but that eerily that's eerily similar to my experience with how I got into games. My first experience, like I said, I'm younger than you. It was of course one of the Mario games, but I didn't have that. It was at a friend's house, and I was blown away by this kind of the similar thought process you had. You're like, I can control this thing on the seat on the TV. Like, I can control it. It was like a playable cartoon. It was like me playing the cartoon. And I understand, obviously, Space Invaders graphics were very different than Mario graphics, but still, that same idea. And how you got that, you had that Pong clone, and how everyone else got bored with it, but you kept still hooked on it. When I got my N64 as a kid, even though I'm old enough that it would have been like a Super Nintendo or something, my parents got it for me a little bit later. And I just stopped playing with all my friends because I just kept playing the N64. And so everyone else was kind of like, oh, that's cool. And then after about a week or, you know, a month or so, they were kind of done with it. But I wasn't. So it's just kind of funny, like, hearing your story of how you got into video games is eerily similar. It's kind of crazy how similar it is. So the next question I wanted to ask is, what encouraged you or what inspired you to get into making video games? Was it, I mean, I would assume it started with your love, but where was that jumping point where you decided, like, no, this is what I want to start attempting to pursue or pursuing in general?
You know, like I said before, I was really into movies. So when I was really young, I thought that's what I was going to do. Anybody would ask me a question like, oh, do you want to be like a fireman when we get older? I'm like, no, I want to make Star Wars. I want to make movies. And all the time, I was growing up in Michigan, and out there, a lot of, even in schools, there was a lot of, I don't know how to describe it. It was maybe just kind of like, I guess like you would be pushed to move into the automotive industry. So even as a young kid, like teachers and parents would always be like, oh, you'd be really good doing this or that, or, you know, design work or whatever in the automotive industry. And I set my sights on movies. And all I would get back is I'd get pushback saying, well, that's really hard, or you're going to have to move to California to do that. And everything's like, yeah. You know, like all this kind of stuff kind of going on. And then they really made it seem like there's going to be incredible friction to pull that off, or it's just really hard for people to do, which is true. It's really hard for people to do. And so I kind of felt deflated until it was third grade, and my third grade teacher came into class after stepping out for a little bit and said, we have a special thing going on today. And they wheeled in on this cart that they had kind of set up an Apple II. And it was the first time I had ever seen an Apple II, or really like a personal computer at that point. And she started to explain what this was for. She's like, it's a tool at the end of the day that can help you do stuff like, you know, complex math problems. You can write on it. You can do all stuff. But she unwittingly probably said the most inspirational thing she possibly could have ever said to somebody sitting in that classroom like me. Which was, she said, this is what you use to make those video games you guys play at, like, arcades and all stuff. The same things are in here that are in those machines, and you can make games using these that end up there. And that, I mean, basically the janitor had to mop up my brains off the floor, because that was, like, so mind-blowing. My friend and I, Charles, who also was just as much a nerd as I was, at that moment, as soon as, like, the whole presentation was done, and it was time for recess, we went up to our teacher and asked and begged her basically to let us stay in on recess to use the computer, because we knew it was a shared resource, but like we didn't imagine any kids wanting to stay inside to use it. So we asked, and we were the first to ask, so we got granted that. So for the rest of the school year, we barely went outside. We stayed inside, and we learned how to program that. So we made these really crude video games, and that was so inspiring, because like I learned really quick, as we'd make these and we'd share them with our friends, we would make games that would make them laugh, and that was like the ultimate like feeling for me. Was like, if I could make something that makes somebody happy and they're laughing at it, that would fuel me to make more things. And the idea of making movies, which seems so impossible and so much friction to try to pull off, kind of faded away, because now I'm looking at this tool and realizing like, this thing is what I need. I can make worlds, I can make stories, I can make action, and everything that would be like the emotional range I would like to try to make in a movie. I can now do that with like direct control and have like direct visceral emotion come out of that for people who are experiencing things that I get to make. So that same kind of itch I was trying to scratch for film, I could do on my own. I was the master of this whole thing. This could give me everything I need to do, from music to special effects, everything could be done on this thing. So that's where it really kind of kicked off for me. It's like the idea that PCs or these little computers were limitless in their ability to create entertainment.
And that's not surprising that you transitioned away from wanting to work in movies to games, because you had, from right there and then, you had that instant feedback. Like, you had that feedback loop established early of, I make this, people like this, and you kind of get that intrinsic reward then of, like you said, like it makes you feel good to make something that other people enjoy. And so it's not surprising that you switched over so early on to switch over to games, just because of that, just because of ease of access. Like, everyone has a computer. Well, not everyone, obviously, back then, but especially back then when it was still such a new thing. But okay, so from there, how did you progress further into the game industry? Like, because this might be something that other people are interested in. I understand the way you entered into the industry is going to be different than how others enter the industry today. But what did you do to get into the industry?
You know, it was one of those things where I think the benefit I had back then is, one, it was all new. So there was no, nothing you could, like, you couldn't go to the internet. There was no internet. So you couldn't go there to find out, like, what should I do to get into the game industry? So I just started doing what anybody back then did. I started a letter writing campaign to all the game companies I could get an address for. And so I would write letters to Activision, Atari, Data East, or any of these. If I saw on an arcade cabinet a company name and it had an address, I'd just write down the address and send them a letter. And I would basically send them ideas. I remember I would type out ideas. So I would sit there and, like, because I had a computer, I didn't have a printer yet, and I had this old typewriter. I would type out a letter explaining what I want to do, and here's a game idea I have. I have, like, three or four game ideas. And then I would, like, take that letter, move over to the left, and type it again and do as many of those as I could. And then I would draw pictures on them and everything like that. And I would send those out. And it was kind of funny because the first response I got back was Atari. And
okay.
I don't think they understood. I don't think they even looked at it, because basically they just sent back a catalog of basically a distributor catalog that was, like, arcade machines. And it was like I could buy arcade machines straight from Atari for thousands of dollars. And I'm like, do they know I'm, like, 10 years old or whatever? And so that was the cool thing was I got a lot of arcade flyers from them. But the worst part was I didn't get anything useful. And then one of the companies that did write back, the only one actually that wrote back with anything meaningful, was Activision. And that was amazing, because not only did they write back, so they kind of gave me some insight into how the industry works. So they were really kind. The letter started with, like, we really appreciate you sending us your ideas. Unfortunately, we can't take your game ideas because there's a lot of legal reasons for that, and we won't go into that, but just know that, like, while we appreciate it and I'm sure we would love your ideas, we really can't look at them and have our game designers look at them. However,
that's surprisingly ethical of them.
It was really good, and they were really good about talking through it so I would understand it as a kid. And but they said, but they understand I want to make games, and so they talked to one of their designers and expressed my desire to be a game designer, and I got a letter of encouragement from one of their designers, and I wish I still had it. I don't know who it was off the top of my head. I suspect it was one of the Kitchen brothers, Gary Kitchen or somebody. But it was this really kind letter talking about the process of being a game designer, what you need to know, and how it's something that's really hard to get into. But if you're, you know, if you get good at home computers and all this stuff, it'll be a lot easier to understand. And then they sent me this pamphlet, which was a type-in program that you could use to type in, and you could control a Pitfall Harry character from the game Pitfall on a Commodore 64. Because I said I had a Commodore 64. And so they sent me this program that was like, here, you can actually get Pitfall Harry running around on a Commodore 64. And it's like, and they're like, and so the thing we would like you to do is, like, type this in, but then try to get him to do other things and let us know your progress. And it was just like, whoa, this was so amazing.
What? Activision, what happened to you?
They were amazing back then.
Biggest takeaway compared to what they are now. They just, like, imagine how many other game designers, and maybe not even game designers, just programmers that they encouraged and, you know, eventually went off into other fields. That is so cool.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Such a great story. Okay, so you learned about a little bit more about the game industry from there. So from what I see on your credits, at least on Moby Games, and maybe they don't have everything, but the earliest credit I found from yours is you worked on NFL Blitz for Midway?
Yeah, so between Activision encouraging me to NFL Blitz, I had done a lot of what a lot of people did back then. I would develop software, and then self-published by actually like putting them in Ziploc bags, Xeroxing instructions, and selling them at computer stores. And so,
do you still have any of those games?
I do. I've been just recently tweeting out some of the stuff I've been finding on my old discs. Like, I had this game that was like a Qbert clone called Sir Bounce-a-Lot. Really creative. I was like 13 or something at this time or whatever, and I it was basically just like Qbert. You're bouncing around, but what you're trying to do, this is the dumbest thing, there's this bridge underneath the Qbert map, basically, and there's these druids for some reason going across this bridge that's over like a lava pit. And you're a spring, and what you're trying to do is deflect falling debris from the druids trying to cross this bridge. I don't know why that was a game idea I had, but like it was just basically my attempt at doing a Qbert game. And there's another one. The first game I had ever written was a game called Destruction Hurdles. And I remember, I wish I still had this one. I remember there was like this room on top of the screen, like this observatory, and there's like these scientists looking down, and you were forced to run left to right and trying to jump over electrified hurdles. And if you touch an electrified hurdle, you just, in a very gory way, explode into chunks everywhere. And I was so proud of that game. It wasn't very fun, I like, in hindsight, but at the time I was like, look at these graphics, and like, your brain's everywhere. And so I would do those kind of things. I did a lot of tools as well. So I wrote a label maker piece of software for the Commodore 64 that a lot of people really liked, because people would like to label their discs, and so I came up with something that lets you do clip art and type out labels and stuff like that. And then I wrote a computer terminal for Commodore 64 bulletin boards. So before the internet, there were bulletin board systems, and you would log into these things and trade software and post messages and do all stuff. A lot of the concepts of the modern internet came out of the bulletin board era. And I wrote a terminal that you would use to connect to bulletin boards, but it'll allow you to do graphical effects. It was kind of like early attempts at like HTML type stuff. And so I did that as well. That did pretty well for me. So ultimately, as a kid, I did decent. I wasn't rich from it, but I did decent off of selling software at local computer stores. And that gave me a taste for what business could be like if I could make games. But then school and everything got in the way. I went to college, did all this stuff. And while I was making fun games on the side, ultimately, it was a chance opportunity to go out to the CES show and try to get try to secure a publishing deal with somebody. So some friends and I got together, we got credit cards and all stuff, and we're like, we're gonna fly out, inkjet printed our business cards, declared ourselves a company, and went out and tried to look for opportunities. And so the first thing we did was talk to like 3DO, Nintendo, all those guys at the show. And the one that actually, this was 94.
Okay.
And we had some little demo stuff that we brought, and the one company that responded to us was Atari, and this is the Atari Jaguar era.
Oh God.
So they responded. They said they can get us dev kits and all stuff. So we're just excited because we're like, whoa, look, we can make games. So
yeah,
we started our company, got everything kind of moving. And the first game we were doing for Atari that unfortunately never shipped because Atari ended up going under before we could was Bomberman, because it was one of our favorite games. And with a little phone ninjutsu, I cold called them in Japan and told them Atari wanted to do it. I told Atari Hudson Soft wanted to do it. And with a little trickery back and forth, eventually got them to understand that like everybody wanted to do this. And so they came to terms, and we're off to the races.
So real quick, before you continue, one, do you still have those Jaguar dev kits?
I do. And so
that's awesome.
They're still at my parents' house, and my brother years ago found the source code to Bomberman. So we have it up and running. It's not very complete,
but it's still though, that's really cool.
It's cool. We have it up and running, and he's finishing up a little bit so that we can release it, because I know a lot of people have been asking us for so many years for it. And like every time I mention it, I always hesitate, because like, oh, I'm gonna make people mad that we haven't released it yet. But it's safe, we have backups, we have all that stuff, so it's gonna come out. We just wanted to make sure it works.
Are you going to release it on like modern consoles? Is that the idea?
No, we're just going to release the ROM. We're just going to let people who are interested in it like be able to check it out.
You should do a really niche Kickstarter and release physical copies for the Jaguar.
Yeah, new Jaguar Bomberman. If I get Konami to let us get that license now.
I know, right? Well, why would they care? The console's dead. They wouldn't. Well, and actually, they want to make money off of it. But that's still really cool, though. That's so crazy. But anyway, sorry, I had to ask that because any type of dev kit thing I'm fascinated by. There's a local game store near me that has a PS3 one.
Yep.
But anytime you have, and dev kits are hard to find in general, so I think it's awesome that you still have your Jaguar one from back in 94.
Oh, yeah, I held on to every dev kit. I've got everything from, like, Jaguar, Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance, all the PlayStations, so cool. all that stuff. Like, because I've worked on every platform, so it's, like, it's hard for me to let go of the dev hardware because you get kind of intimate with that hardware as you're building games. Like, you feels like a member of the family for a while. You know, all the quirks and everything like that, so it's, like, it's hard to get rid of that stuff.
Have you donated any of your stuff to the Game History Foundation?
Less so there, because they're more media side. Like, I've given them source code and stuff like that, but yeah. I've actually donated stuff to, like, the MADE, and I've got a whole bunch of stuff I gave to the Smithsonian, and then I've got a pile of stuff I want to get over to the Strong Museum as well, and as well as the Video Game History Museum in Frisco.
I want to make a trek out there at some point, but
yeah.
Not during COVID, at least.
Yeah.
Not anytime soon. But okay, so after Atari went under, so your Bomberman for the Jaguar didn't go through, where did you go from there?
So I was a bit bummed out about that. We had maxed out credit cards, and we were like, oh, that sucks. This went nowhere. And so I was still in college when we were doing that, so as soon as I graduated, I went into point of purchase sales at this place called Nemax, which sold, like, you know, those scanners at, like, retail and stuff like that. And they sold things for, like, medical stuff. It was basically a tech company. And I was just wanting to get a warehouse job, clear my head, and just, like, replot my career trajectory. Mm-hmm. And when I went for the interview, they're like, well, you know a lot about computers and stuff. It'd be great because you're good. You talk about it pretty well. So maybe we try you out as a salesperson. I'm like, sure, whatever. And then they put me on what they said was the impossible account, which was the tablet computer account, because tablet computers were just had come out. They were very expensive.
Okay.
And nobody knew how to sell them. And because they're expensive, they couldn't imagine anybody wanting them. And so they gave me that, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll see what I can do with this. And so I would go and visit, like, hospice companies and, like, warehouses and all stuff. And the thing I did, because it's the only thing I knew how to do, is I put Doom on it. Because it was a Windows 95 tablet. And I would go and show off how powerful they were and have people play Doom on these tablets. My God, everybody bought them. Like,
the
fact that you could play Doom on it was, like, such a selling point that I quickly became one of the best salesmen there. And, like, just overnight, basically. And people couldn't believe I was pushing them.
Have you been able to... I mean, I don't know if you've been able to, like, rub elbows with him or anything, or bump elbows, whatever that stupid expression is, but did you ever get to tell John Romero you did that?
No, I've talked to him several times, but I've never told him that story. But, like, that... it became so good that, like, I basically would... they would sell themselves, so I would just sit there in my cubicle and just take calls every so often, but I would then just start poking around on some game stuff in my cubicle. And I found a document that this guy down in Alabama started writing, which was the Game Boy development reverse engineering document that he was putting up.
Okay.
This guy, Jeff Frohwine, he was awesome. And so I looked at that, and I went to Radio Shack, got all the parts I needed. I created a little dev kit for Game Boy, and I started recreating one of my favorite Atari games, this game called Yar's Revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started doing it because I didn't have much else to do when these tablets were selling themselves. And while I was working on that, like, the vice president of the entire Nemax company, which had offices all around the country, came for a visit, and he wanted to meet with everybody. And I'm sitting there poking around, and he kind of came in when I wasn't expecting it, and he saw me working on Yar's Revenge. And I'm like, oh, shit, like, I'm busted now or whatever. But he sat down, and he's like, oh, is that Yar's Revenge? And I'm like, yeah. And he was this old guy named Michael Shea. He was, like, you know, old school, just kind of, he came in a suit, you'd never think he would know anything about games.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, he's like, I got a story to tell you. He's like, I used to work for this company in California called Atari. And I'm like, what? He's like, I started Atari when I was a bit younger. And he's like, you know, he's like, it was this crazy place. And he started to, like, it was only supposed to be this little quick meet and greet. He pulls up a chair and then he sits down and just starts regaling me about Atari. And he was saying, like, so he was working in the warehouse. And This is near the time they're getting ready to sell to Warner Brothers. And so, whether this is all true or it's all embellished, I have no idea, but I'm just riveted to it because he starts explaining how, like, one day Nolan comes through and he's like, hey, we're going to get this visit from Warner Brothers. And they had either just acquired them or were acquiring them or whatever. I think they just acquired them.
Okay.
And he's like, they want to come out and meet the team. And he's like, I need all these different people or whatever. And so he was, like, basically assigning roles to people of who they need to be. And Michael Shea, who was going to school, I think, at the time to go into marketing, he's like, so what do you do? And he's like, well, I'm going to school for marketing. And he's like, okay, you're vice president of marketing. You're gonna be that tomorrow, whatever. So like he said, he was just basically thrown in the deep end. So the next day, Warner comes out and they're all these buttoned up New York people.
Yeah.
And they want to talk about the next year's budget, which is like a $500 million budget or something crazy. And he said, like, here he is, this kid who knows nothing about what's going on. And then everybody's looking at each other like, okay, where's the $500 million budget plan and everything like that? And they didn't really have it. And so he said, like, in Nolan's amazing wisdom, realizing they didn't have everything kind of sorted out, basically convinced them to go to the beach with them. And they would talk through the budget and all stuff. And he said, basically what happened was they all go to the beach. Drugs got introduced, somehow convinced these people at Warner to get high with them. And they, that whole night while they're, you know, high and drunk, worked on the budget and figured it all out. And they went back to New York and said, like, and everything was done. He's like, that's how they rolled at Atari back in the day. I'm sitting here like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is like, here I am sitting over here at this dead end job. And like, if anything, this is just proving to me that I belong in games. I don't need to be
you
on a beach getting high.
You could have been doing cocaine with yeah. Nolan Bush now.
I could be doing lines off of like a pinball machine at the beach. So it was kind of funny because, like, here I am, one of the top salespeople in the office, and Michael Shea is supposed to be, like, trying to get me. But instead, he sees what I'm doing, and he's like, you need to just get out there. He's like, you need to make games. You're making this stuff here. This is great. He's like, you should just go do it. And so here's this guy encouraging me to leave the company. Like that. But he was like,
he didn't want to. Money for.
Yeah, that I make money for. But he like, you could see the magic back in his eyes about it. Like, you could clearly see he missed those days. So, I started then putting out resumes to companies in California particularly, and one of them, I love the magazine Next Generation Game Magazine, so I put a resume there and got a call back from Chris Charla, who's the editor-in-chief, and he's like, hey, I'm from Michigan, you're from Michigan, your resume looks really cool, can you fly out and let's have an interview? I'm like, okay. So basically, like, within a week, I was out in California interviewing with Chris and basically this whole team of people who become some of my best friends to this day. We really hit it off, and I started over at NextGen, and I was there for about a year when I made just enough contacts to do some damage on just launching or going into game development full time. And so Chris Charlie introduced me to Andrew Ayer, who's my business partner still to this day, and okay. We started going into business on making games. We started with Digital Eclipse, and it was like these classic game ports to Game Boy Color and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But that quickly grew and quickly grew beyond that and kept growing. And that's what led to where I am today, basically.
And if I'm correct, the only reason I even know this is because I see you interact with Chris on Twitter still. He's with Microsoft now, right?
Yes, he heads up ID at Xbox, but also I think he's head of second party. He's a bigwig now over there, which is incredible. But I've known him since like 97. And you know, we try not to mix up work too much, but at the same time, how can you not when you're making video games? And whenever I work with Microsoft, it's always somehow connected with stuff that Chris is doing or whatever.
That's cool, though. So then you start Digital Eclipse and you get into the industry in pretty much full force at that point. So is NFL Blitz actually your first official release through, like,
Digital
once
Eclipse.
You started?
Yep. So once I started with Digital Eclipse, my first title was NFL Blitz. I signed the contract at a double-decker McDonald's in Burlingame, in California. And we had 3 months to make that game. So I was like, all right. So I started making that game, and I was living in a one-bedroom apartment in the city with my girlfriend, now wife. And I would work at the magazine during the day, and at night I would moonlight and work on this game. So I had 3 months part-time trying to make this game happen. And at one point, Midway is like, hey, we need to speed this up. It'd probably be easier if we send basically testers to your site who can test as you build and all stuff. I'm like, okay, that's great. And then it's like, where are they going to go? Because like, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment. So they arrived to go off the plane. I told them the situation, and they just kind of laughed it off, said like, no worries, won't tell anybody. So they would just hang out at a hotel all day playing the build, and then at night we would get together, meet at places, and go over notes and all that stuff, and then repeat over and over until the game shipped. It was just kind of funny. By the time they left, I felt like we had gotten to know each other more than any other QA/developer ever got to know each other, because we'd literally be sitting on the floor in my apartment really late at night, trying not to be too loud because my girlfriend's asleep, working on stuff, and then, or working out of a restaurant or whatever, or a library. It was kind of crazy.
It's now I wonder, a lot of times when you look back on memories like that, it's definitely like it was a good time, but how stressed were you in the moment during that 3 month period of having to grind that game out?
You know, I am a weird beast. I love that stress. So I thrive off of it. I love the unknown. So it's like, I know that's an anomaly in this industry. After all these years in hiring people, like, people think I'm sick because even now I still kind of like it. Because I like to solve problems with limitation. So it's like, if there's limitations, mm-hmm. I know, like, okay, here's a puzzle to solve. How do we get this to happen in the time and then do our best possible we can do in that situation. So a lot of my game development productions were pretty short, especially on Game Boy. So NFL Blitz was like 3 months. Klax was like 6 to 8 weeks. And I remember Tarzan was like 3 months.
Okay.
And that thing sold 1 million units. It was just kind of crazy. It's like, I was really proud of being able to do good to pretty good games in a short period of time with a high return. And so that really helped get us off the ground, basically.
And you have such a, like I was telling you off mic, but such an eclectic blend of, like, what games you have worked on. Like, you start with NFL Blitz, then the second credit on here is Rampage 2. I'm assuming all these are the Game Boy ports, correct?
Yeah, those are all the Game Boy ports, or they're the PlayStation Arcade ports. And I had different roles on things, so it's like Rampage. There were we did two versions of Rampage for Game Boy Color. I wasn't the direct engineer on that. I was more of a producer. But there's Catherine Bataga and Matt Schneider, where each individually did versions of those games. And I was more or less like the Game Boy producer of sorts. I was still working in engineering games for Game Boy as well, but I was also producing those along with a couple other folks at the studio. So if you look at my credits, like, ultimately, if I look at my gamography, I've touched probably 280 or so games. But like, it's a smaller percentage of like direct engineering or art or music or whatever, because back then you did a little bit of everything. So on some games I would just do animation, and some games I would do full-on engineering for it, or I'd just be a support role in engineering, or I would do audio. I'd do just a little bit of everything.
And, like, looking at your credits, you have a bunch, like you said, you do a little bit of everything. What, I've always wondered, when you get put in, like, the special thanks for a game, what is that usually for, like, did you contribute in a small way to the development, or did you, like, I know this is kind of a weird question, but what constitutes getting a special thanks credit in a video game? Because some of the ones I've seen in here are, you have Castlevania Symphony of the Night, I think that's the PSP release.
That's the 360 and PS3 release.
Okay, because when I click on it, it just takes me to the PS1 link, so I'm like, well, I don't know which version this is. I'm 2007, it could have been any of those. But, like, what is a special thanks credit? Like, what do you have to do to get for those?
In film, it's more like a consulting producer, usually. It's like somebody who's done something of material value for the project, but it isn't really, like, a long-term thing or whatever. Like, it could have very well been, I got the deal secured and brought in, and there's like a business development role. It could have been, I did some art or consulting on it. Like, a lot of it's consulting, where it's like, I'll come in and be like, oh, well, you have this problem, try doing it this way, and do a series of those kind of things. In the case of like Castlevania, I don't even remember where it was. It could have been whatever, but like, but it's more or less like that. Like, sometimes I'll come in and solve problems. So there might be something where it's like, there's a milestone that's behind, and it's because of X, Y, and Z. And it's like, well, tell you what, I can come in and do X and Y till you're caught up and then step away. That kind of stuff. Okay. And sometimes it's just somebody came in and played it and gave feedback and that kind of stuff too.
Okay. So out of, I don't want to go through every single one of your credits, because it is a lot, and that would take a very long time and probably be exhausting for you. So what I do want to ask you, though, is, out of your career so far, what are some of your biggest challenges that you've encountered in the games industry? Or was it maybe like something that was a super crunch deadline that you didn't have nearly enough time that you would have liked to get it done? Or was it something that maybe was you shouldn't have been able to do on a console due to tech limits, but you're able to pull off? I mean, I guess that kind of also leads into another question I had for you, which is, what is one of your proudest, or what's something you're most proud of in one of the games you've worked on?
I'd say mainly because I've always been fascinated with new technology. I don't think there's been a console cycle where we weren't at launch. Maybe this time around with the PS5 and Xbox, we don't really have the launch title stress. So it's probably the first time in many, many years we've had it been in this situation. It's just an odd launch cycle anyways, where it's more of an upgrade sort of thing, but also has like whatever. So it's weird. Yeah. You don't see a lot of like systems selling games necessarily at launch for these titles. But regardless of all that, it's been that. It's like new hardware coming in. And what ends up happening is like there's no best practices set up yet. A lot of software that you need, like SDKs and that sort of thing, are still in flux. And you still have to get a title out at launch. That's the most stressful thing, because there's so many things that are outside of your power. Like, you can't fix all the bugs in the hardware. You can't fix that the SDK is for online support doesn't work yet. You can't fix any of that stuff. So all you can do is wait. And so you can anticipate that by trying to build out what you think it's going to do.
Yeah.
And kind of scaffold it a bit. But at the end of the day, like, you're the last, you're like the last one in, and you have to like try to still hit a date. And that's always been challenging. Things like the Game Boy Advance was really hard to get through. PlayStation 3, because the architecture was so weird. PlayStation 2, because the architecture was so weird, made that really challenging. You know, even stuff like GameCube and all that stuff. But that's usually the most stressful time, because like it usually takes a long time to learn stuff. And like the best time you have as a game developer is at the probably near the end of a console's life cycle, because you understand mm-hmm. the platform so well. You know all the tricks. You know everything you need to do. So if you have something you want to make on it, like there's no question anymore of how to do it. But at the beginning of a life cycle, there's no answers to anything. And in many cases with Nintendo hardware, you would get Japanese development documentation and you have to get it translated, or hope somebody else already translated it. And then even at that point, hope like you could still understand it, because you know it's hard to translate tech terminology. And so you're doing a lot of stuff really fast, and it's very scary. So that's that. But the thing that I'm most proud of, probably, well, there's a few of them, but like I'll probably say one of the most proud ones, there's probably two bookends I'll go with. The first was Tarzan, Disney's Tarzan for Game Boy Color. I was really proud of that, because it was a very short cycle, but I wanted to try to do a lot with the Game Boy Color hardware, because I had done NFL Blitz and I felt like I dropped the ball on that, no pun intended, because I didn't understand the hardware very well. But I, because of that game.
It was your first game, though. So.
Yeah, it was my first game for the system. It was kind of challenging. But then I felt like I really understood the Game Boy Color hardware, and I really wanted to show it off. So working with Activision and Disney on that was amazing, because they didn't believe we could do what we said we would do. We're going to do like thousands of frames of animation, try to live up to the legacy that was Disney's Aladdin on Genesis, and do it all in 3 months. It was like a real challenging thing. But the cool part that came together was Disney animators came to our rescue and said they would like, because they had worked on Disney Aladdin, and that they told us the process, they would do the animation, give it to the guys, and they would clean up for the video game. We did the same thing. So we had a lot of the same people who worked on Aladdin now giving us Disney Tarzan animation. They understood games, so they gave us run cycles and all this stuff, which was amazing.
That's awesome.
And I had written this crazy animation system that could use the DMA to, basically what this means is like you could use the hardware to copy over those frames very quickly. And so I wrote this driver for that. And then we put in Game Boy printer support, which was still very early, and Nintendo still didn't even really understand how to get that to work effectively too well. So we put all this crazy stuff, digital audio, all kinds of stuff in there. And when that game came out, it sold gangbusters. It actually outsold the PlayStation and N64 versions combined, and it got the attention of Nintendo and all these people. I remember being at a trade show. It was E3, I believe. And I saw a group of people from Nintendo playing it at the booth. And so one of the Disney reps brought me over and introduced me to everybody, and it was just like these were people who like had been with Nintendo for a long time, worked on games like Metroid and all stuff, and they were just praising it, which was blowing my mind. I was like, it was insane to me. And I was just so happy to meet all those guys and so many other people as well. It ended up resulting in tons of business. We did so many games after that because they became our calling card. But ultimately it led to us doing Alice in Wonderland for Nintendo, which was kind of my swan song on Game Boy Color. And I've moved on to other platforms after that. But then I'll bookend this with iDARB, which is a game where I had not done much engineering for a long time. And Chris Charla was launching the ID at Xbox program. And so he called me up and asked if we had anything that we would want to do on the Xbox One and through this program. And I was like, well, I've been doing this thing on the side, which I think is what he was really calling about anyway. He named it iDARB, after all, on Twitter, because like I put out a tweet where I had wanted to get back into programming, and so I wrote this program that drew a red box in the middle of the screen, and I just said, it draws a red box, what should I do with this? And so...
Oh, is that what iDARB stands for?
Yeah,
I draw a red box?
Yep, it draws a red box. And so Chris Charlo was the one who said you should call it IDARB, because he's like hashtag IDARB. So I'm like, okay. And then I started getting, thanks to Tim Schafer, good friend of mine who is awesome and funny, started responding with these like really hilarious takes on what you should do with a red box. And because he has like millions of followers, they all piled on. And so I was just off to the races at that point. I'm like, oh, let's just see what happens. I thought it was going to be like the dumbest joke kind of panel I could give at Game Developer Conference, how you don't ask people to help you design a game online. It'd be like, you know, death by a thousand chefs. So yeah. I expected that's how it was going to end and be a funny anecdote. And ultimately, though, it turned into a really good game. And the process was really interesting. And we ended up putting on ID at Xbox, and it did really well for us. And so that's the same thing. You should check it out. It was one of these games that like we just kept throwing everything in the kitchen sink into it because we're just having fun. It was like when I was a kid again on the Apple II making games in the classroom, where everything I would add would make people laugh, and it just made me want to do more of it. And so I would just do updates, share them online. People would laugh, throw more ideas at it, and I just ended up building with this community. And so I was really proud of that. I was really proud of how that turned out.
And that really echoes your first story of getting into game design, in that you first would make games on your computer in school. And I forget, you said middle school or junior high, I think, right?
It was actually elementary school.
Elementary school even. Okay. So in elementary school, and you're making games and then bringing your friends around and them all laughing at it. But instead of just your group of friends, now it's the internet.
Yep. Going around. My greater group of friends and trolls. Yeah.
It's funny though, because you brought up how Tarzan did better than on the N64 and PlayStation. I shared with you off mic my N64 box cut off boxes.
There it is.
Tarzan is one of them. That's what I was looking for a little bit. I was like, I have this game. I will have to look up a copy of that then, because I'm always looking for. I'm actually looking to add to my Game Boy Color and Game Boy Advance collection in general anyway. So. Because I have it's the smaller portions of my collection, and they're relatively inexpensive to collect for, so I'm going to have to look into that then.
One I'm really proud of, I didn't have as much direct, I mean, early on I had a lot of technical contribution to it, but one game that we did that I was really proud of was Dragon's Lair for Game Boy Color, which takes the Laserdisc game and put it on a Game Boy Color, and it's full motion video, it's crazy. A lot of people didn't realize it at the time.
And it's on Game Boy Color?
It's on Game Boy Color, and it's at this point, it's pretty sought after.
That's wild to think about, because I even think about how, like, games that were super advanced. What's the one game, I think it was done by Dylan Cuthbert on the Game Boy. It was like a 3D game. X, yeah.
Yeah.
Games that were just, like, super ahead of its time. So, like, that I love stuff like that. So, I don't have the money to spend on it if it's sought after, like you said. So
I think the price is still reasonable. It's just harder to find copies when they're in the wild. That's all.
Okay. Maybe I'll check out my local game store then. That also reminds me of, I'm a huge Medal of Honor fan. And for some reason, not just Medal of Honor, but for some reason, there's this weird thing on the Game Boy Advance where a lot of developers try to do FPSs on them. And I don't know. I mean, they pulled it off, but it's not great. No offense to the developers, they had to do some technical wizardry to be able to figure that out, from at least my limited knowledge. Because like playing Medal of Honor Underground on the Game Boy Advance, when you're walking down a 3D hallway or something, the textures on the wall move with you, so they'll like cut. Like, if you go to a corner, if you're looking at a corner and you walk towards the corner, you'll see the textures moving into the wall. And so the pattern changes every time you move. It's very uncomfortable to look at.
But you're right. I remember that whole era on GBA where a lot of people were trying to make 3D games. We did a Spider-Man 2 game where we had you web swinging through a 3D city. Really? Because there was a lot of demand for 3D on Game Boy Advance. After Tony Hawk came out, which was brilliant, Vicarious Visions just did an incredible, incredible job on that game. I was addicted to it. Everybody thought, like, okay, at this point, let's make 3D games. And so you had all this stuff, like X versus Sever and all those, like, weird 3D games that came along that were really cool, but also showed a lot of the limitation of the platform.
And, like I don't want to make it sound like I'm, like, trying to insult the developers, because no, I can't make video games. I can't. I actually went to school for game design, and I have an associate's in it, but I realized very quickly that I don't have the patience that is required to be a game developer. And I would get very frustrated very easily. So that's why I kind of like doing this. I like talking to people about it. And I'm happy I've been able to have you on so far. This has been fantastic. One of my next questions for you is, you, like you said, you've developed for a lot of different platforms. What is your preferred platform to develop? Did you like the Game Boy Color more, what, Game Boy Advance, or is it more modern consoles?
You know what? At this point, the older I get, I just like developing on PC now because I can just... It's not like I plan on just making like really advanced games. I like to make retro style games on PC because it's just so fun and I don't have to like worry about memory limitations or any of this sort of stuff. But the most fun I ever had on a platform was the Game Boy Color, because at the time I was younger, I had patience for that sort of stuff, and I could be the best of class on that. And there'd be times that you'd go to a trade show and there's like, you know, Vicarious Visions, ourselves, and a few other developers were really doing cutting-edge things on Game Boy Color. And it was just exciting to be part of that. And, like, Dylan Cuthbert was just a hero of mine. And the stuff he did, and still does to this day, just blows my mind. He's just such a genius. And I can't hold a candle to any of those guys, but I tried so hard to, like, follow in their footsteps.
It's still really cool, though. Like, I don't know. I'm fascinated by game development because I had just enough of an education with game design that it, when I look at a game now, I feel like I have a better appreciation of it. Nowhere near the technical level or even an intimate level of the game design itself, but just understanding the work that went into it. So I don't know. I love hearing those kind of stories of, like, I get war stories, I guess, for lack of a better term, of game development, because I kind of have an idea of what goes into it, just not the full scale. Yeah, so another question. I don't know if you can answer this, but I'm going to ask it. And if you don't want to answer it, we can skip on over it and I'll just cut it out. Are there any, and without naming any names, because I don't want any gossip or anything like that, but were there any projects that you worked on that it was just an impossible task due to either the team you worked with or the company you worked with? And I don't know if there's any way you could tell a story without giving any too specifics. Like I said, I don't want you to incriminate yourself. So,
well, you know, like there's, when you've been doing games as long as I have, you've got a lot of games that were canceled, a lot of games that that changed or were just pushed out that you wish you didn't do it the way you had to do it. There were several occasions where, really, at the end of the day, it comes down to mismatch experience levels on either side. Trying to get something to happen in a way that was like, to give you kind of an idea of like, a lot of stuff is like, subjectivity is a hard thing to cope with when you're developing something creatively. And sometimes you're paired with people at companies who are actually much greener than you would hope for. And so you might have the most seasoned team in the world, but you're still answering to somebody who, this might be their second game.
Okay.
And but they have a lot of ambition, but they don't have any understanding of the process or anything like that. So that happens rarely, but when it does, it's a really frustrating situation because you are just, I mean, you're really just battling the inevitable cancellation of a project because you know right away, especially now, I can see it miles away, actually, that we're going to walk into a situation where this person who has a lot of authority doesn't really have the creative chops to pull off something, like whether it's an original game or whatever. So we were in situations where we're working on some high profile games with some really good publishers, and for whatever reason they would have somebody internally that we were answering to that were more or less placed in their position as a family member of somebody high up or whatever, and you're just sitting there, it's like classic sitcom type of thing where it's like the guy working for the boss's son and you're just like, ugh. It was that kind of situation, and it's just like we've had games that would have changed the trajectory of our careers canceled because of that situation. And it's just, yeah, it happens. And people have been doing it long enough. They have the scars to show to show everybody.
And I'd assume after, like you said, with enough experience, you kind of have ways to work around it and mitigate it as much as you can. I feel like everyone has had a similar experience in their job where, whether it doesn't have to be game design specific, but where you're just working with someone who's trying to enforce a mandate when they know nothing about the process.
Oh. we've all done it.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't have too much more for you. I asked a lot of the questions that I wanted to. I have the last couple that I have, though. For people who are looking to get into the industry, what are some pros and cons that you've experienced working in the industry? And what would you say, I know it's hard to boil down to like one or two things, but what's one of the best pieces of advice you could give to someone who wants to get into the game industry today?
The best piece of advice that's always been, it's proven itself out time and time again, is if you want to make games, there's nothing stopping you from making games right now. Go out there, get Unity, get Unreal, get Game Maker, get whatever tools you need to. Just start making things. And the biggest thing you can do is learn, probably the most valuable thing you can do is demonstrate to someone that you can complete a concept. And don't set your sights too high. Don't try to make, you know, the next Metal Gear or whatever. try, this is part of the process. Like, figure out an idea that you're compassionate about, that's scaled to the right size that you can actually finish. And if you can't do it yourself, figure out who you can bring on board to help you do it and get it across the finish line. Because a finished game, it goes way farther than any resume or any, even just doing QA work as you come into the game industry. To finish a game means you have to understand scope, budget, time. You have to make sacrifices, and you can demonstrate all that with a complete game. If you walked into an interview, for me, when I walked into an interview, I had a videotape of all the games I worked on. Some that were never finished, some that were finished. I had demos ready to go. And it was just like one of those things where it's like, I felt like I wasn't really being interviewed anymore after that. It was more or less like, how soon can you start? And we've done that with other people. We had a guy who, previously to working for us, was a sanitation engine. It was a manager for a sanitation engineering company. And he came in with a Game Boy cartridge that he burned himself with a port of this classic game called Hard Hat Mac that Electronic Arts made, because it's okay. One of his favorite games. He figured out how to, one, make cartridges, burn the EEPROMs, program a game, import something, did the audio, the graphics, everything, and brought it into his interview. And we're just like, dude, you're hired. Like, how soon can you start? Because this is amazing. And he was one of our best producers ever.
And that's definitely, like, I agree with that. I mean, granted, I'm not in the industry, but I used to do interviews for one of my jobs. Like, I would interview new employees. And one of the things I always remember looking for is, like, are you able to solve problems? Not necessarily that you have the skills right now to do what we need you to do, but are you able to troubleshoot through what we need you to do in order to get to that? Because if you can't solve problems, you're not going to make it far in just about any position you're in, yep. No matter what, no matter whether it's video games or otherwise.
Yeah.
Okay. And so my last question for you is the Video Game History Foundation. I first heard about you, and I talked to you off mic about this. I first learned about you through Retronauts, which I drop a reference to them all the time on the podcast. And they did an episode when the Video Game History Foundation started. And actually, listeners will remember two episodes ago, I recorded an episode with Dexter Morrill about video game preservation and video game history, and we talked a lot about the foundation. And Mike, you are part of the foundation, correct?
Correct. I'm on the advisory board, and I've known Frank for quite some time. I worked with him, of course, at Digital Eclipse before that.
I guess in your words, as someone who works for the Video Game Foundation, Video Game History Foundation, what do you guys do? And I think Digital Eclipse is pretty closely tied with that too, with your work with like the Mega Man Legacy Collection and the SNK Collection.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what Digital Eclipse does, our mandate and what we try to do is bring classic games forward and modernize them here and there with modern accoutrements like online multiplayer and all that stuff. But we also build out these comprehensive museums for each product. One of the biggest museums we worked on was for the Street Fighter Collection, 30th Anniversary Collection, and we try to basically not only perfectly recreate these games in all their glory and pixel glory of what they were before, but also show them their best light today, so make sure they're the games you remember, not necessarily like to the letter. So that means refining controls and all kind of stuff. And Frank was a huge part of our relaunch of Digital Eclipse, and sometime through that relaunch, both he and I and several, like Steve Lin and several other people who've been involved, Kelsey and crew. So like we're all passionate about game preservation and had all these really basically efforts that we were kind of doing individually to try to preserve games, source code, archive media for games and all stuff. Mm-hmm. That Frank, the most inspired of the group, set out to create a nonprofit that would charter itself to be kind of like a destination for information on game preservation methodology, and ultimately the act of preserving things is one of its main effects. And like just recently, for instance, they launched the Source Code Initiative, to try to gather and collect source code to projects that can be buildable and use and reference for generations from now. And the best example of that was like Secret of Monkey Island, where Frank was able to reconstruct missing scenes from the game from the source code and share that with people, which was just mind-blowing. So the Foundation's efforts in game preservation aren't that they're trying to collect up all artifacts and everything like that. They have one of the most comprehensive like media archives. When you think about game magazines, they probably are the best in the world. But ultimately, they work with other museums and foundations and preservation groups to coordinate game preservation and make sure that we're all doing this objectively and trying to preserve games in a way that's going to help generations beyond ours and inform people about what it really was like to make games, produce games, what the game industry was, and what it, like, and the things that were going on that may not even have been released or came out, having a complete and comprehensive history of all that.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I first, you know, wanted to connect with you, just because I love, I'm the same way. I love video game history and video game preservation. I don't consider myself like a preservationist or anything like that. I mean, I have a collection, but I love what the Game History Foundation does, is where they try to preserve the context of video game history more than just the physical, than the physical manifestations of it. And I won't go into it again, because I just did an episode two episodes ago about it. But no, this has been a really fun episode. Thank you so much for joining me on this, Mike. Is there anything you would like to plug, and where can the good people find you on social media?
So if you go to Mike J. Micah on Twitter, I'm pretty active on there. I, you know, when I'm not posting dumb pictures and saying funny things, like I do often show some of the my work in game preservation, or at least do a lot of nostalgic stuff for people. So you can find me there. You can go to digitalclips.com to see what we're doing at Digital Clips, or otherocean.com, if you will, on the other side of things, where we do a lot more higher profile, like modern stuff. Our game out, we have a game out there right now called Project Winter that's doing extremely well. It's in the same genre as like Among Us and other games. That's been great to us. We have, of course, the Samurai Showdown collection, which just recently came out, which you can go out and find. We've got about four or five other things we're going to be announcing here pretty shortly that are on the Digital Clip side. And then on a personal note, if you have Netflix, do check out Glitch Text. It's an animated show that I consulted on, and my role and in shows like this and in movies is I come in and I try to make sure that games are presented in a way that represents who gamers are and are shown in a positive light, and that they're authentic. So like a lot of times in the past, like a lot of TV shows and movies will do really dumb things with technology. Like you'll see somebody like kind of slapping their hands on a keyboard and make like, you know, a jet crash out of the sky or whatever. Like my job is to come in and make sure that like the things look authentic, it's realistic, and it's putting game development and games in a light that's a lot more positive. So my next thing, so Glitch Text, an animated show, great for kids and adults. Check it out. It's on Netflix right now, two seasons. And then this December, I think it's December 12th or 10th, the movie Free Guy comes out. It's a Ryan Reynolds movie. It's about an NPC. It's about an NPC who suddenly realizes he's in a video game, and he suddenly comes to life, and craziness ensues. And I played a production consulting role on that, and really did a lot of production design work with Ethan Tobin, and worked closely with Zach Penn and Sean Levy, the producer and screenwriter and director, to like make sure that games were shown in a way that was really authentic. And it was amazing to work with this group who were like so concerned about being genuine in that area, that like there's scenes where you'll see like notes from our studio hanging on the wall, which are essentially notes about the networking code that was in Street Fighter, or like all this kind of stuff. It's like they were really authentic and everything. We sent out like a big chunk and swath of our office to help decorate and set decorate stuff there as well. Really? As like we had a lot of like I had a lot of say in how to present things in the story and all stuff. So to me, it's that full circle thing where I, as a kid, I wanted to make movies, but it seemed impossible, and then I got into games, and now games led to me getting into film and television.
That's so cool, man. That's such a, definitely go check all that stuff out, guys. Like oh my god, Free Guy, and then Glitch Text, right?
Glitch Text. T-E-C-H-S. Yep.
I was looking it up on my phone while you were talking, just to see what it looks like, and the art style looks really cool.
Oh, it's like so good. Like Dan Milano and Eric Robles, the two showrunners. Eric is the guy who really took control of the look and style and the animation. He's amazing. He's like, God, if you love games, just watch, you can tell he loves games too. And the motion, there's this episode early in the first season that is a spoof of Castlevania, and the action and the movement in that is just like, if you like Castlevania, you'll recognize just poses and glances and all stuff that just like really tips the hat to it.
Is it like the stiff animation of Simon Belmont with the whip?
Oh yeah, there's all that kind of stuff in there. And like, they would tackle different game genres every episode, and it was just brilliant. The whole team was brilliant. The writers were incredible. It was just such a fun thing to work on, and I feel in debt to those guys because they really worked hard to make sure that this thing was going to be, you know, something that like kids can really get into. But at the same time, there's hints of like how the technology really works.
That's awesome. Well, as for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillLoadingPod on all of them. You can also email me, StillLoadingContact@gmail.com. If you want to support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. You can support it by going to Patreon, patreon.com/StillLoadingPod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. Probably even more beneficial, just giving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps gain exposure for the show and helps more people find it. And I'm part of the Podbeard Network. You can go to podbeardnetwork.com and check out all the shows that the network offers. And finally, the most important shout out that I have is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. If you want to check them out and consider donating, you can go to bitbybitfoundation.org. And that will wrap up this episode of the Still Loading Podcast. Mike, I seriously can't thank you enough for joining me on this episode. So thank you once again for joining me.
And thank you for having me, Josh. This was really fun.
And that will do it for this episode. I will see you all next time.